Kane turned slowly, with a mocking smile of confidence on his face that he didn't feel. Two armed people, a man and a woman in hard suits, flanked McCann. The man pointed an Uzi at Grant, and the woman trained a gyrojet pistol on Bridget. Their glittering eyes bespoke a total scorn for life, their own and any other's. Although they didn't look alike, in stature they were almost identical. Both people were honed to a razor-keen tautness of attitude, as if held in check by woven steel leashes. The man's head was shaved, and he affected a cup-and-spiral tattoo on his forehead. The woman's face was scarred. Kane figured she was the bull dyke Phil Boyd had mentioned. A sense of violence moved with both of them, like the clammy touch of a wind blowing from a slaughterhouse. As tall as the guards were, almost as tall as Grant, who was imposing by any standards, the figure between them was even more powerful and dynamic than the two people, shrinking them to relative insignificance. Whereas the guards wore the drab gray hard suits, McCann's long, lean body was draped in an armored ensemble that mixed the medieval with the futuristic, or the alien. From wrist to throat and heel, he was clad in supple molded leather, dyed a bright red and decorated all over with plates of silver, each embossed with a different swirling glyph and intricate interlaced design. A long, deep purple cloak fastened to his shoulders with golden torques belled out behind him like the wings of some great bird. A gauntlet made of beautiful silver alloy encased his right hand and forearm. Sparks of blue fire hissed and crackled between the fingers. The pride and wisdom Grant, Kane, and Bridget had all seen in McCann's high-planed face was still there, as well as deep, abiding loneliness. His eyes were pits of black shadow now, swirling with a malign energy. The notion flickered through Bridget Baptiste's mind that here was a man who had watched the march of history from the sidelines, but who could have had a devastating effect on it had he so desired. An electric aura seemed to surround him, the same kind of energy radiated by dozens of conquerors and men of destiny who had shaken the foundation of the world.
I apologize for not meeting you at the station, but to be perfectly frank, I issued specific orders that you three should be persuaded to arrive by an altogether different route. Am I to apprehend that my representatives were not wholly successful in their techniques of persuasion?
You might say that. Just like you might say none of your representatives will be in the persuading mood for a long time to come.
You'll suffer as they suffer, Dung Dog.
Dung Dog? Is that any way to talk to guests during a reunion?
It's an epithet Shade reserves only for native Terrans. She and her companions were born on the moon and feel somewhat alienated from the planet that birthed their great-grandparents.
I remember that hostility. And what are you called?
Rashid, brother of Saladin.
The man bit out his words with such harsh emphasis they sounded like whip cracks. His dark eyes bored in on Grant and Kane.
My brother whom you two killed.
Neither Kane nor Grant responded to the accusation, even though it was less than accurate. Bridget smiled at the man.
Thank you. Do you know where our friend might be found, Rashid?
The big, bald man blinked in bewilderment at Bridget's pleasant, forthright manner. Automatically, he opened his mouth to reply, caught himself, then scowled at her.
On your knees! On your knees before the first prince of the Tuahadidanan!
The three outlanders remained standing, surveying Rashid with expressions of mild amusement.
Now, if we can get back to the main discussion...
Rashid growled and took a step forward, raising his Uzi. Kane and Grant swung their sin-eaters in his direction, but he behaved as if he didn't see them or didn't know what they were. McCann lifted his right hand, which sparked with little threads of energy.
It is not necessary, Rashid. You may not think it seemly of them, but we will allow our guests to remain standing. For the time being.
Eyeing the pulsing lens on the palm of the metal glove, Kane made a very obvious show of shifting the barrel of his pistol to train the bore directly on it.
What would happen if I shot that little piece of costume jewelry on your hand?
McCann gazed at him speculatively for a long moment, and the black of his eyes suddenly lightened, first to a dull gray, then they acquired a faint pinkish sheen. He didn't answer.
I don't think any of us want to find out.
Kane sensed Bridget and Grant staring in tense concentration at the lens. Shade and Rashid both leaned unconsciously away from McCann.
Usually, I tell people to raise their hands, but I want you to drop yours and take off that glove while you're at it.
Slowly, McCann lowered his hand, but he made no move to take off the gauntlet.
I prefer to keep it on. I tend to catch chills easily in this place. That's why I wasn't disinclined to leave here all those centuries ago.
Where is Lakesh?
Safe. As safe as his interfacer. Both of them await my attention.
For what?
That is what you shall learn, along with Lakesh.
Take us to him.
Of course, but first you must disarm.
That's not going to happen, elf boy. The plan for the day is for you to send one of your psychotic ass-kissers to fetch Lakesh and his machine. Once that's done, we'll give you about 3 minutes to convince us why we shouldn't shoot you dead for what you did to our friends and to our home.
The half-smile on McCann's face widened, and his eyes acquired a discomfiting yellow shimmer.
Shade is right. You Terrans are dung dogs.
With a swift scutter and scuffle of bare feet sliding over stone, interspersed with metallic clankings, transadapts boiled out of the shadows. 14 of the little men clustered around the 3 outlanders, their eyes glittering with hate. From the horde rose a murmuring titter. Most of the transadapts were armed only with edged weapons, makeshift poleaxes, and spears, but they acted as if they not only knew how to use them, but also as if they desperately wanted to. Brigid, Grant, and Kane stood in the center of the wheel of sharp steel, their hearts trip-hammering within their chests, their faces composed.
At least we know what happened to the transadapt population in the colony.
A ragged figure pushed through the throng of gnomes and strutted up to the 3 people.
I said you'd die if you stayed here.
Big orders, small-timer.
On your knees.
In your dreams.
I'll rip off your balls and feed them to your woman.
Be silent.
But my prince...
Enough. We do not waste our time on crude physical threats, do you understand?
David dropped into a groveling posture, his hooks clicking on the stone floor. McCann smiled genially at the 3 people.
Forgive him. He hates humans very much in general, and you 3 in particular.
He just likes to threaten and scream and switch loyalties. It's who he is.
I understand. I hope you understand why your own threats will never come to fruition.
Your fused-out gnomes don't worry us as much as you think they should. We've had a lot more experience kicking their asses than you have ordering them around.
You are brave. All of you are brave. But like most humans, your courage derives from rash stupidity.
Maybe so, but we know what you're hoping to accomplish with the interfacer working in conjunction with the infrasound transmitter here in the pyramid.
What I am hoping is of no importance to you, Bridget. You and your friends are so very close to death that I can only presume that you are seeking to distract me by acting as if my intentions are childishly transparent. Please do not bore me further with such a display. All of you, Kane in particular, know I have some small degree of psychic ability.
Bridget recollected that McCann had denied being a telepath, although he conceded a large number of the Tuatha De Danann were adept at the art of mind manipulation. He claimed the human mind was very easy to trick, to feed illusions of invisibility and shape-shifting, abilities that folklore attributed to the Danann. However, McCann possessed the ability to interact with brainwave patterns, to sense emotional states, intercepting intent, to receive flashes of insight.
So what? There are plenty of Psi-muties on Earth who could run rings around you, telepathically speaking. So you don't impress us by boasting about it.
Kane spoke the truth as he understood it. Mutants with obvious physical characteristics were dying out, partly due to the long campaigns of genocide waged by the Baronies, but primarily because most of the human muties had reached evolutionary dead ends generations before. The general supposition had always been that the muties, human and animal alike, were the unforeseen byproducts of radiation and other mutagenics. Lakesh had indicated otherwise, claiming if radiation and or chemicals were the sole cause, then logic dictated all human mutants would be similar, nor would the non-adaptive traits have lasted beyond a single generation. Genetic codes scrambled at random couldn't account for the many different monstrosities and deformities among men, women, and animals. According to Lakesh, most of the hordes of muties that once roamed the outlands were the result of pantropic sciences, the deliberate practice of genetic engineering to create life forms able to survive and thrive in the post-nuke-cost environment. However, one breed of human mutant that had increased geometrically since Skydark was the so-called Psi-mutie, people born with augmented extrasensory and precognitive mind powers. As Lakesh had said, these abilities weren't restricted to muties, since a few norms possessed them as well. But generally speaking, non-mutated humans with advanced psionic powers were in the minority. McCann sighed as if Kane's comment vexed him.
Kane, I owe you a bloodletting, but I am not a vengeful man by nature, nor do I easily forgive. You humiliated me and imprisoned me, and for that you must be duly punished.
Oh, please. Do you have any idea how many assholes with attitudes have uttered that very same lousy cliché to me?
McCann's eyes flamed up, as if the fires of hell erupted from the sockets. They instantly filled Kane's field of vision, overwhelming all of his perceptions. The shock was so unexpected, so terrible, he nearly collapsed. Time, space, the universe darkened and tilted. His surroundings shattered into a kaleidoscope of flying fragments. He drifted among them, and the sudden terror of it dragged a scream up his throat. He clamped his jaws shut on it. Quite suddenly, he was in the pyramid again, standing in front of McCann, surrounded by transadapts. Kane's heart drummed in his chest, and his head ached, and his body was filmed with cold sweat. The psychic assault wasn't a fraction of the intensity of the one McCann had inflicted upon him on the moon, but he wasn't inclined to make a comparative analysis at the moment. He smiled contemptuously.
Is that the best you can do?
McCann's face lost its facade of gentle good humor.
By no means, Kane. Hasn't it occurred to you that I may choose to punish you by inflicting great pain, a maddening eternal agony on these two friends of yours?
Kane swallowed hard, realizing anew that McCann was no ordinary adversary. He briefly relived the terror he had felt of the man during their struggle in the lunar catacombs. He had always secretly feared he would one day cross swords with his superior, and during that fight his fear had seemed to come to life and take physical form. He knew the statistics for survival in his chosen profession were discouragingly low, but so far he had beaten the odds. He couldn't deny he and his friends seemed to lead exceptionally charmed lives, but he knew his own personal string of good fortune couldn't last forever. He had made too many powerful enemies, brought too much hell in his wake. Hearing the rapid respiration of Bridget behind him, Kane knew the same uncertainty about McCann gripped her and probably Grant as well.
Point taken.
He retracted the Sin Eater into its holster and began to unstrap it from around his forearm. For a long time, longer than Lakesh cared to recall, the damp stone walls, the dim light bulb burning overhead, and the hard stone bench had been pretty much all of Mars he had been allowed to see. Set in the wall was a massive metal door with huge strap hinges of thick iron and a heavy lock in the center. The door looked as if it hadn't been opened in centuries, and perhaps it hadn't until McCann had pulled it open to admit him into the cell many hours before. Still, neither McCann nor any of his people had abused Lakesh since their arrival in the Sidonia compound. However, a hook-handed transadapt made it abundantly clear he wouldn't be averse to employing his prosthetics for mutilation. For that matter, he knew McCann's bodyguards, Rashid and Shade, would gladly kill him, given the slightest provocation. Fortunately, McCann needed his expertise with the interphaser, and more than likely his knowledge of hyperdimensional physics as well. He couldn't help but wonder why, since he was certain McCann's race had forgotten more about the subject than humanity was ever likely to learn. Lakesh sighed and shifted position on the hard bench. He shivered, despite the environmental suit he had been given by his captors upon their arrival in the Sidonia compound. The temperature was uncomfortably low in the pyramid, perhaps only a few degrees above freezing. The suit's internal thermostats couldn't keep him warm without the helmet to complete the microenvironment. Regardless of his physical discomfort, Lakesh still retained the sense of awe that almost suffocated him upon his first sight of the pyramid from the bullet car. Walking through the monument was like entering a long-lost world of the past, a world of the god Luk, of the goddess Danu, of the Sitha, and the other world of Tir-Nanog and all of its fabulous wonders. He didn't need to be informed the pyramid was honeycombed with rooms and passages. The light and the recycled air indicated a power source either activated or installed by Sidonia compound colonists was still functional. Lakish briefly wondered at the sheer number of man-killing hours the colonists had devoted to exploring and even excavating the vast monolith. Thinking about such things kept his mind from wondering about the possibility of rescue or release, and replaying his last sight of Domi. He felt rage rise and then subside in him. He was a man of science and couldn't allow raw emotion to sway him now. He sensed with a bowel-tightening prescience that his time in the pyramid was running out. Metal clanked loudly on the other side of the door. Lakesh quickly stood, resisting the impulse to back into a corner. He watched as the door swung slowly inward on squeaking hinges. Three black shadows glided in, and Lakesh felt his nape hairs prickle in an instant of superstitious dread. Then one of them spoke.
Thought we'd drop by for a cup of that green Bengali tea you like so much.
Fresh out.
The shadow suits lent Kane, Bridget, and Grant a sinister aspect, but the garments had become important items in their ordnance and arsenal over the past few months. Ever since they'd absconded with the suits from Redoubt Yankee on Thunder Isle, the suits had proved their worth and their superiority to the polycarbonate magistrate armor, if for nothing else than their internal subsystems. Manufactured with a technique known in pre-dark days as electrospin lacing, the electrically charged polymer particles formed a dense web of form-fitting fibers. Composed of a compilated weave of spider silk, monochris, and spectra fabrics, the garments were essentially a single crystal metallic microfiber with a very dense molecular structure. The outer monochris sheathing turned opaque when exposed to radiation, and the Kevlar and spectra layers provided protection against blunt trauma. The spider silk allowed flexibility, but it traded protection from firearms for freedom of movement. The inner layer was lined by carbon nanotubes only a nanometer wide, rolled up sheets of graphite with a tensile strength greater than steel. The suits were almost impossible to tear, but a high enough caliber bullet could penetrate them, and unlike the mag exoskeletons, wouldn't redistribute the kinetic shock. Still, the material was dense and elastic enough to deflect knives and arrows.
Surely you three didn't arrive in those clothes.
Kane hooked a thumb over his shoulder toward the doorway, where the woman named Shade lurked.
We took them off so they could be searched.
And to keep you from getting ideas about trying to escape, you'd die in minutes.
How long do we have to stay in here?
Until one of us tells you to come out.
She didn't pull the door closed, but stood just outside in the corridor, hand resting on the butt of her gyrojet pistol.
When did you return from California?
Yesterday evening. So you've been here for about 30 hours, give or take a few minutes.
And what was the resolution of the mission there?
Unsatisfactory.
Bridget proceeded to provide him with a brief overview. Making no comment, Lakesh's only response was to tug absently at his nose.
You don't seem very happy to see us.
In truth, I don't know how to feel. I had hoped to complete whatever task McCann set for me, then be returned to Cerberus. But it's apparent now he's been waiting for your arrival before proceeding.
Proceeding with what?
I confess I'm not quite sure, but I think it may have something to do with aligning the energy helixes of the interphaser and the pyramid's transmitter.
Kane nodded as if everything now made perfect sense.
I see. And Baptiste here thought he was fooling around with a silly theory about mirror matter.
Dearest Bridget, that's exactly what I think. You've made up my mind. I am very glad you're here.
Don't get all giddy on us. We're unarmed and outnumbered and at the mercy of a mad god.
A mad god? I seriously contest any assertion of McCann's divinity, sane or otherwise.
Domi coined the phrase, not me. She...
Domi? She's all right? You spoke with her?
Not for long. Defore sedated her.
She was conscious when we left, but Defore had her confined to the infirmary.
Bridget saw the alarm spreading across Lakesh's face.
Reba says she'll make a full recovery. She took a jolt of infrasound.
I was there. I saw it. McCann used the silver hand of Nuadu on her. Poor child. As if she hasn't been through enough in her young life.
So you made the Nuadu connection too?
It was a fairly obvious one to make, and certainly with what we've learned about the Danann science of sonic manipulation. Evidently, McCann's gauntlet emits a tightly focused infrasound envelope. But like the ones in use by the hybrids, it can't propagate destructive waves over an extended distance.
Oh, really? The op center looked as if it had been used for artillery practice.
Yes, that's because most of the damage was caused by conventional firearms.
Maybe so, but his glove is still damn dangerous. I read up on infrasound weapon experiments after our first exposure to the wands. We were very lucky that when the wands resonated with our body cavities, our internal organs didn't turn into jelly. Probably the only reason they didn't was because of our mag armor. So don't try to tell us McCann's glove is primarily for show.
By no means. I'm not trying to downplay how dangerous it is, but it's not quite the doom weapon of Celtic myth either. If this situation arises, we ought to be prepared to take advantage of its limitations.
What's with this we shit, Lockish? You know you mean me and Grant.
I said we, and I meant it, you self-righteous bastard. If you hadn't been off on your foolish mission to California, more than likely we wouldn't be having this conversation, certainly not in these surroundings. Don't you dare imply I'm delegating all the risks to you while I sit back and criticize from a safe remove.
Kane didn't interrupt Lakesh's angry tirade. He listened without flickering so much as an eyelash, feeling the prickles of shame and embarrassment warming the back of his neck under the high collar of his shadow suit. Neither Brigid nor Grant offered words of defense, but he knew he didn't deserve them.
Reprimand accepted. I was way out of line. We were told how you led the defense of Cerberus.
It was my worst nightmare given flesh and form, friend Kane. Forgive my short temper. Whatever McCann has planned for us, it can...
Put these back on.
Rashid appeared in the doorway. He tossed the Cerberus team their EVA suits.
You'll need them where you're going.
After they were suited up, they stepped out into the passageway where Rashid thrust their helmets into their hands.
Don't put them on until you're told.
McCann stood at the end of the corridor, holding a large aluminum-sided carrying case. All of them recognized it as the container for the interphaser and its support systems. It was outfitted with O-ring seals to make it air and watertight. He nodded to them and turned smartly on his heel, his cloak swirling in a dramatic fashion. Kane, Grant, Brigid, and Lakesh followed McCann along a stone-floored path through an arched entrance, flanked by Rashid, Shade, and four transadapts, including David. Rashid and Shade had their helmets tucked under their arms, and they fisted firearms in their free hands. They strode down a circular flight of stairs, worn smooth by thousands of years of feet, passed through another arched portal, and entered a vault-walled chamber of huge proportions. Brigid, Grant, and Kane had been there before, but Lakesh gaped around in goggle-eyed surprise. The chamber was so vast that its nether end was lost in the shadows. Six circular tiers descended to the center of the chamber, surrounding a column-like dais raised 6 feet from the floor. From it, a metal shaft rose straight up to the shadow-shrouded ceiling. Rising from the base of the dais, extending at ever-increasing angles into the high shadows, was a taut webwork of silver filaments, hundreds, perhaps thousands of them. They were all connected to the series of circular tiers. A dim glow came down from the pointed roof, glittering from the strings. As before, Kane had the impression of vast energies being drawn down from the metal spire and disseminated through each one of the silvery threads. The mass of stretched-out strings vibrated gently, continuously, producing a bass note that he felt rather than heard.
Do you know where you are?
The tuning chamber of the Danann Broadcast Tower.
Exactly.
We've been here before. The last time we found an old man living here, trying to readjust the frequency.
Yes, Micah Harwin. I was told of him. No one knows his fate. You understand the purpose my people put this pyramid to, don't you?
It transmitted ultrasonic frequency fatal to the Archons, the first folk, to keep them from establishing an outpost here.
And to keep them from absconding with the pyramid itself.
McCann smiled when he said it, so no one knew if he was joking or simply as mad as Domi had suggested.
So... you were afraid Balaam would steal this monument?
Yes. The power it once possessed cut a path like a scythe through the earth. Millions died by incineration so swift they never knew it.
Are we talking about the protoplanic force Balaam and his people used against your settlement on the moon? The one which caused a blowback effect?
And nearly destroyed the earth.
Is that what you're planning to do again? Is that what you need the interphaser for?
By no means. I need the interphaser to go through the looking glass.
He walked quickly and deliberately across the chamber and through another arched portal. The people from Cerberus were pushed ahead by Rashid and Shade at gunpoint. Only shadows waited ahead, and Lakesh stopped moving.
Where are you taking us?
Do you find this place so strange, my friends?
No stranger than many other places we've seen.
I promise to show you a place stranger than anywhere you have ever been before.
A muted bell sounded, then lights flickered, illuminating the murk. They stood in front of a square cubicle, like a three-sided box. They saw it was a lift with silver fretwork like that of a giant birdcage. McCann made a sweeping gesture with one arm, indicating they should enter. The four people didn't move, despite Rashid pressing the bore of his Uzi against Lakesh's back.
Where will this take us?
Down. Far, far down. To the seat of the broadcast tower. There is insufficient oxygen for you down there, so you may wish to put your helmets on now.
Reluctantly, the Cerberus team stepped into the lift and did as McCann said, slipping the helmets on over their heads and helping one another secure them to the collars of the EVA suits. Rashid and Shade donned their own headpieces. They weren't surprised that the transadapts took no precautions, since they were bred to function in rarefied atmospheres, but they wondered at McCann. He seemed to sense their mystification and gave them a sly smile.
I will find such environmental conditions invigorating, as long as I don't overstay.
The lift began its descent, dropping smoothly down a vertical shaft. As it did so, they felt the lessening of gravity in their bodies. The open side of the elevator afforded them tantalizing glimpses of the other levels of the pyramid. They saw walls tiled in Celtic patterns with blues and reds and ancient knotwork designs, received impressions of huge tables and chairs carved from oak, brilliant colored tapestries. On another level, they saw a collection of curving harps, the brass frames gleaming. They passed chambers furnished in a bizarre blend of the traditionally ancient and the technologically advanced, with computer consoles and view screens side by side with flowing tapestries. They glimpsed displays of broadswords, maces, suits of medieval armor, halberds, pole axes, and battle standards from thousand-year-old military campaigns. There was too much to absorb, much less easily identify. The elevator continued to sink downward through the relics of a lost world, of a distant past humanity knew only from legends, folklore, and mythology. Kane glanced over at McCann. His black eyes held a vacant sheen as if he gazed mournfully down the long track of time. He recalled what the Danann had said to him on the moon.
A man is born in one world. Dead. Age and death came at last to everything there. I cannot live with the dreams of my world haunting me at every step.
McCann suddenly stiffened, his gaze sliding over to Kane, who didn't look away. McCann stared at him intently, but his eyes didn't change color.
Do not pity me, human.
So noted, Prince.
The elevator passed another level, and it was the most uninteresting by far, seeming to be little more than a converted warehouse. It looked to be nothing but a dimly lit space filled with stacked crates and boxes, most of which were stenciled with the legend NASA. Others read Parallax Red, Cydonia Compound. He also spied a number of the air sleds, a couple of which were filled with boxes. He realized the craft were actually more like dollies or forklifts rather than actual vehicles, which explained their altitude limitations. The elevator bumped to a stop. A long passageway stretched before them, made of rough-hewn ancient stones set in huge blocks without mortar. Kane exchanged glances with Brigid, who nodded knowingly. They were at the lowermost level of the pyramid, within a foundation buttress of the enormous structure above. It was dark except for a feeble light glowing ahead, down the throat of the corridor. McCann stepped into the passageway and marched deliberately toward the glimmer of light, his cloak streaming out behind him. David pushed against the backs of Kane's thighs with the curved ends of his hooks.
Go!
Ow!
Kane, Lakesh, Brigid, and Grant entered the corridor, followed and bracketed by Shade, Rashid, and the transadapts. Stout stone columns rose from the floor, and red dust puffed up around their feet, the residue of many centuries. The passageway ended after a few dozen yards at an arcaded opening. They walked through it into a cavernous gallery, which reminded Kane of a stupendously huge well. It was at least 1,000 feet in diameter. The people stood on a wide ledge that circled the well. The walls were formed of a gray, molded substance which looked like sponge, undulating in curving waves and involutions. Extending down from far, far above glittered the metal shaft of the Danann resonator. The shaft terminated in a huge crystal cluster that reminded them all of a huge chandelier. Cain, Grant, and Brigid knew the universal power source of the Twaha de Danann derived from sculpted crystals. The cluster hung about a dozen feet above the circular platform made of a highly polished alloy. A wide walkway of the same kind of material extended from the ledge and joined with it. From the exact center of the platform, directly beneath the crystalline point, rose a slender dais. It wasn't more than 5 feet tall and terminated in a flat, perfectly square top. Cain couldn't help but think it was the perfect size and shape to hold the interphaser. A man stood on the platform dressed in an EVA suit much like Lakesh's. The face they saw through the helmet's visor bore ugly bruises and flakes of dried blood. When he saw Cain, Grant, and Brigid, George Newkirk's eyes flashed with shocked recognition, but he reacted to McCann's presence by dropping instantly to his knees, bowing his head, evidently awaiting either deliverance or death. McCann swept majestically out onto the walkway, taking long-legged strides, the aluminum carrying case swinging jauntily at the end of his left arm. Everyone else hung back on the lip of the ledge, looking around nervously. The transadapts gave the distinct impression they had never visited the cavernous chamber before. Halfway out on the walkway, suspended above the pit, McCann glanced over his shoulder and stabbed four fingers at Lakesh, Cain, Grant, and Brigid in an unmistakable gesture for them to join him. They didn't move. David pushed against Cain's leg again.
Ow!
Get out there!
The crystalline cluster at the tip of the shaft shivered slightly, emitting a bell-like tone that climbed into an almost painfully high whine they felt vibrating against their eardrums, even through their helmets. The vibrations corresponded exactly with each one of David's words.
What the hell? This chamber is like a gigantic ear canal. The acoustics can amplify or modulate the resonances created by any sounds. See that spongy substance on the walls? That paneling keeps the sounds from escaping or dissipating. It bounces the noise back to the crystal.
McCann, on the platform, gestured impatiently toward them again. Cain stepped gingerly onto the walkway, glancing over the side. There were no handrails, only an edge that seemed to plunge straight down into darkness. After a couple of steps, he realized the substance beneath his feet didn't yield or sag, so he marched across it self-confidently. Inscribed on the floor of the platform in highly polished silver was an intricate symmetrical pattern of looping, interlaced, and interlinking curves. Cain, Brigid, and Grant had all seen the design before and knew it was called a Celtic wheel or knot. The various loops and links were arranged in accordance with the compass points, representing the facets and pathways of life. The square-topped dais rose from the center of it. McCann laid the case atop the dais and stepped to one side, pushing Newkirk out of the way.
Lakesh, please make your mechanism operational.
Lakesh hesitated a moment, then stepped forward and undid the latches on the case, lifting the lid. He removed the little metal pyramid and its support systems from their hollowed-out foam cushions. Deftly, he attached the small power unit and then pressed a seam on its alloyed skin. A small keypad slid out from the base. A faint, low-pitched whine emanated from the interphaser, just at the edges of audibility. McCann watched him, as though he found his activity of only vague interest. While he worked, Cain stared intently at Newkirk, who affected not to notice.
Who smacked you around like that, George? Somebody else you betrayed?
I didn't betray anybody. I was always in league with McCann. I wasn't a traitor.
You've run a thorough check on the power conduit, George?
Yes, my prince. It functions perfectly.
Good. Then I have no further use for a traitor.
Without altering his expression of mild interest, McCann planted his gauntleted hand against George Newkirk's chest. The man instantly flew backward as though he were performing a reverse broad jump. He hurtled over the edge of the platform and into the darkness below. He disappeared into the black pit. McCann returned his attention to the interphaser, idly scratching at his cheek with his beringed left hand. Cain, Brigid, and Grant stared at him, nonplussed by the swift and casual way he had murdered Newkirk. Lakesh seemed to be unaware of what had happened. He completed setting up the pyramid and stepped back from the dais. It emitted a steady hum like an engine on idle. McCann eyed it critically and then nodded graciously to Lakesh.
Thank you. Now, for your efforts, the least I can do is supply an explanation.
The pitch and timbre of his voice seemed to have no effect on the crystal mass hanging above them.
Kane, Bridget, I know you have some knowledge of my people's history on Earth. Do you know why they left?
Kane recollected the information imparted to him by Fand during their encounters.
Most of the Tuatha De Danann left Earth around 453 AD by the old calendar. The Irish clanspeople had outgrown you. Christianity had come in. Your science was condemned as sorcery, and even you mentioned persecutions.
And before we lived on Earth?
I always assumed your race came from another planet, like the Anunnaki.
We did. That planet was this one. Mars.
Mars? That's impossible. Mars hasn't been able to support even bacterial life for millions of years.
This particular Mars, the Mars of this reflection, has been barren for a very, very long time. But it was not so in my universe.
Are we back to parallel casements again?
Not precisely, friend Grant. We're talking about a mirror Mars, aren't we?
We are. Your own primitive scientists undertook mathematical investigations of the theories dealing with the plurality of universes.
It sounds like the sidereal space routine to me.
The theories are connected, but there are important differences. There are four known fundamental forces of nature: gravity, electromagnetism, and weak and strong nuclear forces. Gravity is quite familiar to most of us. It keeps our feet on the ground. It keeps our planet and all the other planets in our solar system in orbit around the sun, and keeps the sun in orbit around the center of our galaxy. Electromagnetism is no less important. While it is gravity that holds us down, it is electromagnetism that stops us from falling through the floor. Weak and strong nuclear forces are of equal and fundamental importance as all the others.
Gravity can be described in geometrical terms as a curvature of four-dimensional space-time, while the other three forces are described in terms of symmetries or an abstract internal space, which has nothing to do with ordinary space-time as you understand it.
And what the hell does that have to do with why you invaded our home and killed our people?
Imagine that for each type of ordinary particle, there is a separate mirror particle. That is, not only do we have photons, electrons, positrons, and protons, but we also have mirror subatomic particles. In nature's mirror, not only space is reflected, but also atoms, molecules, cells. Do you understand now?
I think I do, McCann. The relationship between ordinary matter and mirror matter is somewhat like the relationship between the letters B and D. So while neither B nor D is symmetric together, they are in fact mirror symmetries, with the two letters interchanging in the mirror image. Therefore, the properties of the mirror particles would turn out to be very similar to ordinary particles. For example, the mirror particles must have the same mass and lifetime as each of the ordinary particles. Otherwise, the mirror symmetry would be broken.
As she spoke, Kane mentally reviewed what they had all learned about McCann's people over the past couple of years. Obviously, the Danann deeply understood the indivisibility of space and time and of matter and energy. They knew all of them were interchangeable. One turned into the other and vice versa, according to the application. The deeper the Danann scientists probed into the very composition of matter, the building blocks of material objects, the more they found energy and complexities of energy at the bottom of everything. Thousands of years earlier, the Tuatha De Danann had mapped all the quantum pathways, the vortex points on Earth. According to a priestess of the Priory of Awan, the Danann bolted into the vortex points and scattered themselves. The Celtic cup and ring markings, as well as the knot patterns, were one-dimensional depictions of multidimensional geometrics. He grudgingly admitted the Danann had earned the right to take pride in their accomplishments. Nor was it completely their fault that primitive Terrans regarded the lordly Tuatha De Danann as gods from the stars.
So the Danann came from a mirror universe, a reflection of this one, not from another planet in this galaxy.
Yes.
How?
I thought that would be obvious to you by now, Kane. This pyramid is not just a structure, but a vehicle which for thousands of years permitted access to this universe that coexisted with mine. My people isolated a technique for translating the reality of one universe into its reflection.
We brought our entire culture, our whole race here.
Backward and forward and sideways did she pass, making up her mind to face the cruel looking glass.
You're not far wrong. This structure is a kind of transportation device, a giant interfacer or contiguity which was originally built to pass backward, forward, and sideways through the two universes.
And now you want to go back through the looking glass, to return from this reflection into another one.
McCann nodded, pointing to the interfacer, the dais, and then to the crystal hanging over the platform.
Yes. By tying in your interfacer with the primary power conduit, the necessary energy will progress through the resonance shaft to form a single conclusionary flow at the apex. The energy flows in a helix spiral pattern exactly opposite and of equal frequency, and the intensity on each side of the vortex at any given point will trigger a quantum induction shift by vibrational resonance. The shift will then feed into the propagation medium, which will expand the field influence and...
Why?
I don't understand the question.
You left your home universe to come to its reflection. You've been here for thousands of years. There must have been a reason why the rest of the Danann returned through the... What do you call it? The contiguity? And abandoned you here without a way to rejoin them?
I was not abandoned.
You could have fooled me, Mac.
Do not presume too much. You stand there now only because I am indulged in a whim. Do not provoke me into changing that whim into wrath.
The mad god's wrath.
And you believe your sex will keep you safe from it.
Answer Grant's question, why don't you? Why did the Danann leave you in this reflection?
You ignorant savages could not understand our reasons.
Right. You freely chose to remain here, a magician, a scientist, a prince among ignorant savages. We're not buying it, McCann.
Do you wish to share the fate of George Newkirk? He suggested this undertaking to me, and as you witnessed, I dealt with his treacherous nature, not his scientific knowledge or devotion to me.
So, you betrayed him without a second thought. No big surprise. Will you reward their devotion the same way?
I did not propose to engage in a debate as to my motives.
Fine. We'll just be on our way. We'll leave you to whatever activities you wish, and you can have the interfacer.
No.
No what? No, you don't want the interfacer, or no, we won't be on our way?
No, you won't be going anywhere, except with me.
What the hell does that mean, Mac? I thought you were taking a trip back through the mirror.
I am. I will activate the contiguity and translate all of us into the reflection of this world.
You want us to go with you? What the fuck for?
McCann turned toward him, lifting his gauntleted hand, little bursts of energy flaring between the fingers, energy shimmering within the lens.
Have a care, Grant. My reasons are beyond...
Very basic. That's why we couldn't figure them out. McCann, you wanted to extinguish the sun with the accelerated entropic gradient produced by the Devil Platform. You wanted to kill yourself, but in your infantile egomania, you couldn't picture the world, the universe, going on without you. So you decided to take millions of lives with you, like an old pagan god who measured the degree of his divinity by the number of lives sacrificed in his name. Don't you get it? This sick bastard couldn't figure out an appropriately apocalyptic way of committing suicide, one that's worthy of his stature, so he's changed his mind. Now he's taking his toys and going home. In this case, we're his toys. He still needs worshippers, and the handful we represent is a pretty pitiful testament to 10,000 years of strutting around, being adored by simple clanspeople. But he'll take what he can get. He probably thinks we'll provide him with more by breeding with one another.
Kane stared transfixed at McCann, almost overwhelmed by astonishment.
She's right, isn't she, Mac? The reason you never tried to make the transition back to where you came from is because there are no worshippers there. Hell, there might not even be any of your own people there anymore. You wouldn't be a god there. And that's probably the same reason you didn't return to Earth after you were resurrected from stasis on the moon. The people on Earth wouldn't be impressed by the idea of becoming agrarian peasants, kissing the ass of a god who throws temper tantrums every time the barometric pressure changes.
Is that it? This entire operation? The attack on Cerberus or the killing? You're abducting me? isn't so much the desire to go home again as to feed your insane hunger to be worshipped.
Is your plan to settle us in the Mirror Universe Ireland? To force us into a simple pastoral life where we sacrifice goats to you whenever we want it to rain?
McCann regarded them all expressionlessly from beneath lowered brows.
You are all very bright and resourceful. You have skills and knowledge that would be useful in building a new world. I found your courage, camaraderie, and humor intoxicating. Reminders of why I loved humanity so much at one time.
Then his eyes seemed to burst into flame, lighting his face with eerie, hell-hued streaks. Lifting both hands, he curved the fingers into talons.
Why do you seek to oppose me? Why defy me, McCann, prince among the Danann, killer of the Fomari, conqueror of the Firbolg, sorcerer, warrior, a legend even in the old days of the Danann Empire? I reigned in the Dimlands ages before your white Christ was born. I died, but not as men die. I slept and awoke again, and all the old empires had crumbled to dust or were drowned by the sea. I lived on. What are you humans anyway but shadows in the eyes of the gods? And your arrogant, barbaric race thinks it can survive without its ancient masters.
McCann thrust out his arm, the fingers of his gauntleted hand spread wide, energies pulsing and throbbing within the lens.
You will follow me, dung dogs, or you will die in screaming agony. Aye, and all whom you love will perish neath my hand as well. Choose!
And what is it like on your side of the mirror, Mac? Better or worse than this side?
Worse. Much, much worse.
How so?
You'd think your planet was devastated by war, but our entire universe was dying. Long, long ago, it was much like yours. That was when we of the Tuatha De Danann rose to grand civilization and glory. The scientific powers of our race so expanded, we were able to spread out and colonize the worlds of many stars. It was an age of high technology, of discovery and exploration. But that was eons ago. The inexorable laws of entropy took effect, and as the suns of our universe burned out, we had no choice but to migrate, to retreat. Eventually, we realized there was no place to retreat to and save our civilization. But our retreat went on for millions of years, withdrawn from our colonies. A universe does not die overnight.
Then why return to it?
The laws of entropy will reverse themselves when the cooling of our stars reaches a critical point.
That's only a theory.
Human physicists might have believed the second law of thermodynamics was immutable, that the flow of energy into lower forms is a one-way, irreversible process. Even your own Einstein admitted that cosmic laws were immutable in appearance only.
So you postulate the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty might rule in cosmic as well as atomic physics.
Yes, I'm pleased you understand.
If indeed the curvature of four-dimensional space collapses, the immense amounts of free radiation compressed into a small sphere of space-time would build rapidly into new nebulae, suns, even planets.
And if I can keep my race alive in some fashion until the critical point is reached, and perhaps it has already been reached, then the Tuatha De Danann will be reborn.
For what? So another cycle of gods and worshippers, masters and slaves can begin again?
I don't think you need our help to recreate a universe like that. Nor do you need the pleasure of our company.
I will be the one to make that determination.
Uh-uh. You're wrong again.
Her hand darted forward and struck the enter key on the interfacer keypad. Almost immediately, a glowing funnel of light fanned up from the metal apex of the pyramid. It looked like a diffused veil of flame, and it expanded into a swirling borealis several feet above the dais. At the same time, on the far edges of his hearing, Kane sensed a distant, muffled roar. A sound he couldn't focus on, or even really be sure he heard. Kane instantly grasped Brigid's strategy. The pyramid obviously occupied a vortex node, a naturally occurring geomantic interface point of the Martian electromagnetic grid. Activating the interfacer without encoding a parallel set of transition coordinates was tantamount to kicking open a door in a submarine. Energy flooded in to fill the entire cavity within the pyramid.
No!
McCann shifted the pulsing lens of his gauntlet toward her. Moving with a speed surprising for a man his size, Grant's hand shot out and closed around McCann's slender right wrist from underneath. He wrenched his entire arm upward. Infrasound leaped from the lens in a rippling flow, striking and engulfing the crystal cluster suspended overhead. The ripple splashed back, striking the lens on the gauntlet. McCann tried to tear himself free of Grant's grip, his face demonic with rage. A halo of coruscating light surrounded the glove, and Grant guessed the blowback overloaded the gauntlet's delicate circuitry. Everyone's helmet suddenly filled with a series of painfully loud squeals, pops, and a hashy hiss of static. Grant's fingers loosened in reaction to the onslaught of sound, and McCann yanked his arm free. He launched a kick at Grant's stomach, his boot landing solidly. Pain streaked through Grant's torso, and he staggered backward. He would have plunged from the platform if Kane hadn't caught him. The volume of the cacophony blasting into their helmets through the UTEL transmitters faded to a strange, whispery echo. The crystalline mass changed color, shifting through all the hues of the spectrum. A twisting tendril of softly shimmering light poured down from one of the points to wrap the apex of the interphaser. The throbbing, echoing whispers swelled louder, and all of them felt a corresponding vibration build in their bodies from the bones outward.
We've triggered a feedback pulse, some sort of resonant power surge. There's no place for the buildup to disperse, so it will keep bouncing back.
A parabolic shockwave bowled all of them off their feet, sent them rolling to the edge of the platform. A great gust of sound battered at their senses, followed by a maddening hum that scratched at their nerve endings. Smoke billowed thickly from the interphaser, streaming from every seam. The dais itself glowed red-hot, plasma crackling in dazzling blue skeins all over the metal surface. McCann's cloak was on fire, and he beat at the flames enveloping it. The oxygen in the pit wasn't sufficient to maintain the fire for very long, but before it was extinguished, his cape was little more than a scorched rag. His gauntlet, the deadly silver hand of Nuadu, spit little sparks. Its artfully crafted silver segments were blackened, half-slagged scrap metal. The lens on the palm looked like a cheap bauble made of glass. Struggling to his feet, Kane saw that the wave of force had extended outward from the platform and flattened all the people on the ledge. Rashid and Shade stirred feebly. The transadapts lay sprawled and unmoving. Without the hard suits, they had taken the full brunt of the feedback pulse. A strange dark halo shimmered from the crystal cluster, expanding like a wave sweeping outward. Kane felt the throb of it within his skull.
We must get out of here. The vibrations of the resonator are building to critical mass.
I figured it was something like that.
His temples feeling as if they were caught in a vice, Kane began a shambling sprint across the walkway. He glanced back once. From the facets of the cluster, great whorls of color spiraled out, growing in size and brilliance like immense flowers of flame blossoming into life. He saw Bridget running after him. Lakesh stepped onto the walkway, intending to follow Bridget, but a steel-hued arm encircled his neck from behind and jerked him off his feet. McCann sent Lakesh reeling almost to the very edge of the platform, but Grant snatched him by the wrist and hauled him back. Without a word, Grant closed in on the crimson-eyed McCann. He threw the first punch, but McCann brushed it aside with a forearm and sidestepped, avoiding another blow. Grant moved in quickly and pounded two solid punches to the man's midsection. He took them without even so much as a grunt of pain. With his right arm, McCann aimed another blow at his face. He managed to catch Grant's right wrist and bore down, grinding flesh and tendon against bone, trying to force him to his knees. Teeth clenched, Grant resisted. He wasn't a small man by any standards, but in McCann's grip, he felt like a child. The Danann grinned, showing his teeth, eyes blazing like two coals dug out of the hearth of hell. Grant locked his gaze on McCann's face and refused to bend. In his mind and heart, it wasn't a struggle between man and man, but between ancient ways and new, between the concepts of master and slave. Anger washed over him like a tide as an image of Domi, barely able to move or to talk, filled his mind. Unexpectedly, Grant bent at the knees, as if being forced down, then he lunged forward, passing under McCann's arm on his right side, turning and dragging his arm backward, forcing it in a direction neither human nor Danann arms were designed to bend. He twisted it up into a hammerlock and seized a handful of McCann's long hair with his left hand. He slammed him face first against the dais, cranked his captured elbow skyward, levering it up until he heard a mushy crack. It was a sizzle as of meat on a hot griddle, and he threw himself away from it. His pale face bore a red streak of seared, blistered flesh. He tried hooking Grant's leg with his own, but Grant simply dropped on top of him, his fist striking him on the point of the chin and bouncing his head against one of the interlacing loops of the Celtic cross design. His face, a half-mask of blood and burned flesh, McCann was somehow able to reach up with his left hand to catch Grant's downward-plunging fist. He was unable to stop it, and Grant's right fist came down like a rock on the side of McCann's head. The head rolled to the side, and he didn't move, his grip loosening and falling away from Grant's fist. Panting, Grant crouched atop him, as if suspecting a trick, hand raised to strike him again. But McCann didn't stir, and Grant slowly pulled himself erect, swayed for a second, then staggered out onto the walkway. Lakesh came after him.
Are you all right, friend Grant?
Fools!
Grant!
Lakesh wheeled to confront McCann and saw the ugly welts of burns on his face and the way his right arm hung dead and useless at his side. But McCann smiled in savage satisfaction as he pulled back his leg to kick Grant again, to kick him off the platform.
No!
Not having any time to think, Lakesh bounded forward, cannonading his entire weight into McCann's body. McCann stumbled and staggered. For a frantic instant, he tottered on the rim of the platform, clawing with his good hand for a grip to prevent his fall. An image of Domi with the silver hand of Nwadu pressed against her forehead flickered through Lakesh's mind, and he kicked the man with all his strength. McCann toppled over the side. For what seemed like an eternity, Lakesh could hear his shrieks as he plunged down and down. Then it ended abruptly. Breathing hard, blinking cold sweat from his eyes, Lakesh turned toward Grant and helped the man to his feet.
I ask you again, friend Grant, are you all right?
That depends. Where's McCann?
Right about now, coming to rest in his own Tir Nanog, I hope.
A grating, crunching rumble swallowed up the incessant keening hum in their helmets. Both men glanced up as a pouring of powder sifted down from above. Without another word, they began to run across the walkway to the ledge. Kane and Brigid were engaged in a struggle to get past Rashid, Shade, and the Transadapts. The Transadapts, hemorrhaging from their ears and nostrils, were in poor shape to put up much resistance. Brigid's right leg whipped up in a swift, spinning crescent kick. The side of her boot knocked one of the gnomes into two of his companions, piling the three of them up in the corridor. Rashid raised himself to his knees, and even through the visor of his helmet, Kane saw that his eyes were glassy. He swung his Uzi around, but Kane kicked him square in the chest, knocking him backward, his subgun falling from his hands. Kane reached for it, but felt his right leg being pulled out from under him. He went down on top of Shade. He slapped her gyrojet rocket pistol aside and lunged again for the fallen Uzi, even as Rashid scrabbled on the floor for it. He kicked free of Shade and wrestled with Rashid, rolling over into the corridor, slamming into a support column. At the same time, a dazed Shade struggled to her feet and bent to retrieve her rocket pistol. Brigid brought her heavy-treaded boot sole down on the woman's wrist. Shade's fingers opened around the butt of the tiny pistol, and with her other foot, Brigid kicked it over the side of the ledge. Shade lunged upward, catching Brigid at the knees and muscling her over onto her back. The two women rolled into the corridor where Kane and Rashid fought for possession of the Uzi. They collided with the men and the subgun fell from Rashid's hands. Kane grabbed for the machine pistol, missed, and tried again. He secured his hold just as David rose up, hooks held over his head. He was wild-eyed, his ratty hair hanging in his eyes. He swung the hooks from shoulder level, straight at Kane's faceplate. Having no choice, Kane lined up the Uzi muzzle automatically and fired a dozen rounds. Grant and Lakesh pounded into the corridor just as David's body settled to the floor, both of them wild-eyed.
You fools! This place is shaking itself apart! We've got to find a way out of here!
Kane wasn't sure if Lakesh included him and Brigid in his fool's remark, but Rashid stopped struggling long enough for him to break free of the man and to climb to his feet. He looked into the pit and saw the hanging crystal cluster surrounded by a bubble of quivering ripples through which coruscating particles of brilliance shot. Rolling, multicolored clouds overlapped, engulfing it and the platform.
Where is McCann?
Never mind him. We've got to get
McCann!
Shade pulled between the two men, shoving them aside. Rashid followed her out onto the walkway, reaching for her. As both people reached the halfway point, a torrent of stone blocks cascaded down from above with a thunderous roar. Great slabs of rock fell and crashed. The four people wheeled and raced down the corridor, the floor quaking beneath their feet. Fragments of rock pattered down all around them. The walls showed cracks, and rocks and mortar shaken loose from the ancient walls overhead sifted down. The pyramid heaved and shuddered around them.
Where are we going? To the train?
No one had any breath to answer. Everyone was too occupied with trying to maintain his or her balance and footing on the convulsing floor. Blocks of stone dropped like bombs from the ceiling. They reached the end of the corridor and the lift car. Brigid batted the lever to the up position and fell back against the wall of the elevator, gasping for oxygen. The car rose rapidly to the level above. When Kane glimpsed the scattering of boxes and crates, he slapped the lever to the mid position, locking the lift in place.
What the hell are you doing?
Those air skids. The sleds. We can use them to get out of here. We'll never make it to the train before this place buries us alive.
No one argued with him. They dashed out of the lift and into the warehouse area. The far wall was covered by a massive steel shutter, and Kane's eyes frantically searched for a way to open it. Bridget pointed to an elaborate chain and pulley contraption. Grant bounded to it, giving the device a swift visual examination, and yanked at the handle protruding from its base. With a clanking crash and a shower of rust, the steel panel dropped open, revealing a black, star-speckled sky.
This was one short-ass day. Seemed long enough to me.
How do you get these things to work?
Kane, Grant, and Bridget turned to see Lakesh on his hands and knees inside an air sled.
I don't have the slightest idea.
A huge stone cube tumbled down from overhead, driving up jets of dust.
We better get ideas, and fast.
Kane found controls on the underside of the sled's forepart. They were very simple, consisting of a pair of knobs and a gear shift-like control stick. He kneeled in front of the controls, twisting the knobs experimentally. The sled suddenly rushed up from the floor with tremendous acceleration, flinging him backward and entirely out of the craft. He hit the floor with an impact that momentarily stunned him, but he glimpsed the sled smashing headlong into the wall above the open portal. The nose flattened and bent back on itself. It dropped atop a stack of boxes and toppled them.
Shit!
At least we know how to make them go. Let's try them again.
The four people climbed into individual air sleds, inserting their knees into special hollowed-out sockets. Flexible metal straps passed around their legs and secured them in position.
The motive power appears to be an electromagnetic field that alters graviton levels.
The knobs control your speed and altitude. You use the stick to steer, and for attitude.
Let's get the hell out of here!
The air sleds rose from the floor and shot toward the opening in the wall as if they'd been launched from catapults. Inestimable tons of thundering stone collapsed behind them, and they barely kept a few yards ahead of it. The craft flew up and out into the cold Martian air, not more than 20 feet above the desert. Kane goosed his sled to its highest speed and twisted around to take a look. He saw black cracks 100 feet across zigzagging through the pitted face of the pyramid. It seemed to implode, crashing inward, block after block collapsing and then scattering in exploding fragments. The walls folded in on themselves, cascading in a contained avalanche. The four of them followed the trail made by the monorail for the Cydonia compound, reducing their speed only a trifle. When the domes of the colony came into view, Kane felt it was safe enough to land and look behind them at the pyramid. Veiled by swirling clouds of dust, the ancient monument of the Tuatha De Danann settled to the Martian desert like a massive grave marker. A pillar of whirling dust and grit rose toward the sky. They followed its ascent with their eyes. Phobos was cold and hostile in the infinite darkness of the Martian night, regarding them with indifference. The Milky Way was a silver ribbon of frosty brilliance across the black sky. No one spoke for a long time. Then finally, Bridget broke the silence.
It was all over for McCann long, long ago. I can't help but wish this had turned out differently.
We fought for every inch of ground we've gained to free ourselves from baronial slavery. If it had ended any differently with McCann, our fight wouldn't have meant anything.
How can we judge McCann by our standards?
Easy. He lies there, covered by the same dirt that's at our feet.
Lakesh looked up toward the moon Phobos.
Shadows in the eyes of the gods, indeed.
Outlander's Mad God's Wrath is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2004, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Azelford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, Timberly Chanel, Kate Torrey, and Colleen Delaney. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Azelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Brian Rogers. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title. The Executioner number 307, Hard Pursuit. We got him. Amur ibn Laoud, wealthy terrorist mastermind, is in the custody of the FBI. He sits, bound hand and foot, in the hold of an airborne C-130, for the moment.
We have an enemy aircraft shadowing us. This aircraft is under threat of a shootdown. Get your people prepared now.
Hydraulics are going dead!
I'm bringing her in! Brace for impact!
Get them! Get them all! I want them all executed!
Now Laoud has escaped with American hostages. Mac Bolan, along with FBI agent Orlando Wasdy and U.S. Marshal David Kowalski, pursue them from the broiling desert sands.
You think the three of us can take on a squad of Islamic ninja terrorists on motorcycles? It's pretty long odds.
You get used to it.
To a tanker in the middle of the ocean.
Stryker, what's your sit rep?
I'm in the hold with the fuel tanks right now. I need you to get those men out of here ASAP.
You mean you're gonna set those charges? The minimum safe distance is...
unreachable. They've been swimming for it.
Holy shit.
Ready to finish this day off with a bang?
Breaking news. We have just received a video purported to be from the group responsible for the massive explosion in America's heartland today.
Our strike against the United States had a number of objectives. To pay back the United States for the unprovoked and cowardly attack on Iraq by letting the American people see how it is to suffer. We also wanted to show that Americans are not safe at home any longer. We have the means and the will to strike within your borders when and where we like. The American government is powerless to stop us. There will be more attacks. We have our people in place and we have the weapons. Prepare yourselves. America's days are numbered.
Saddam Hussein's regime has not disbanded. They have been reunited by a man the world thought dead. They are gathering the money and the weapons to make good their threats. And the only things standing in their way are the men and women of Stony Man Farm, the president's covert intelligence agency.
Move it! Move it!
It's time we started to hit back using their methods. It's time we stopped playing by the rule book our enemies discarded a long time ago.
You will tell us what we need to know, Mr. Schwartz. Who has betrayed us?
We have God on our side. That is why we will destroy you, because we are chosen.
Stony Man number 76. Gathering Storm. Be there. Your life depends on it.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.